times have changed, and media has changed, and the world has changed. But if you look at the oath of office or the affirmation of office, which it more properly is, it is about being a protection for the Constitution. And of course, if we go back to the time that the Constitution was written, you had Mussolini, you had Franco, you had Hitler, you had Salazar and so on all over Europe. And they came to power in various different ways. And it was important that the president was seen to be above day-to-day politics, so that if there was a constitutional crisis, that they would have a big moral force in reining in any temptations that might be there. And we see in other countries at the moment that the idea of having somebody to rein in any overambitious people could be very important.
Hello again and welcome to the Insights podcast with Sean O'Rourke. My guest for this edition wears a lot of hats in his everyday life. He's a former government minister and TD, a former co-op manager, campaigner, Gaelgor, husband, father, historian, prison negotiator and very importantly, a rural neighbour. Eamon O'Queeve is part of one of Ireland's most revered political families, the grandson of Fianna Fáil founder Taoiseach and former President of Ireland Eamon de Valera. Eamon O'Queeve himself has enjoyed an eclectic political life and, although no longer a TD, he shows few signs of slowing down. Eamon O'Queeve, you're welcome to the Insights podcast. You could actually have been a Dublin politician because you grew up in the capital, but then in your early 20s, early to mid-20s, you headed west.
Well, yeah, absolutely so. I grew up in Pembroke Park, which is Donnybrook, Ballsbridge area. I went to school in Mount Merion, so I passed RTE on my way to school over many, many years, and I went to college in UCD. So I had never actually lived in a really rural area until I went to Connemara. But obviously, in the family background, there was a big interest in the Irish language on both sides of the family. My father's family were very involved with the Irish language, and my father himself, you know, was a professor of Irish. So Irish was very much in the background and an interest in Irish as a spoken language. I went to college. I did science in college. I met my wife to be during those years. So I decided in college very early that I wasn't cut out to be an academic. I thought I'd like something in management. By pure chance, I landed a job as the manager of a co-op, but the co-op consisted of a committee and a remit to, well, the first job was to build a lamb fattening station for 2,000 lambs. Now, I knew nothing about sheep, but the committee decided that I was the person to get the job. Now, I think I actually was second choice and first choice didn't take the job, but that's another day's work.
And how did you go about building that and how big did it become and how successful?
I went to Connemara and a lot of things surprised me at the time. Now, obviously, the infrastructure was abysmal. Roads were very, very poor. Getting telephones was a major problem. It took a year and a half to get a telephone line as far as the co-op. I remember going to farmers' meetings and the first thing I had to learn before going to the meetings was, you know, that you had a ewe, a ram, a lamb, a haggis and so on. And I had to learn all of those in Irish as well. So you had the Quinnabwinn and the Multicus, Uscan and all the rest. And pretend I knew something. So we set about building the lamb fattening station. With the oil crisis of the 70s, the lamb fattening didn't really work out. That is now the site of an absolutely massive timber mill. We set up a small stake mill making fencing stakes now, not stakes you'd eat, but fencing stakes in the late 70s. But we were still struggling. Not an easy thing to make money from. And one day, a person that I knew walked into my office and said he was setting up a mill in South Galway because he had decided to leave his present employment in a timber mill in East Galway. And that's how I knew him. I said to him, would you run our mill for 6 weeks? He said, yes. And after 6 weeks, he dropped his original plan and he said, you give me this mill, I'll make a job of it. And a job he surely has made of it.
Still but a going concern, supporting how many jobs?
Well, directly in the mill, I was 150 jobs. But then if you take another 100 jobs locally in the trucks and so on, and then if you went nationally, it's supporting about 400 jobs.
What drew you into active politics?
What drew me into the co-op and working in a cooperative rather than for personal profit. Making money personally never had that huge an attraction for me. Was, I suppose, my upbringing. And people always think you've one upbringing, bringing a grandfather, but in our case, it came from both sides of the family, and it came very much from my parents. But when I was working in the co-op, you found that there was so much of government policy that wasn't, certainly wasn't rural friendly, and also issues in relation to the Irish language, because we had set up an Irish college and it was very much in a Gaeltacht area, and promotion of the language was also part of the co-op. One of the interesting things, if you say, what got you into politics? The same thing that got Paul O'Fuil into politics. And Paul O'Fuil was another co-op manager in South Connemara. And the interesting thing was that both of us landed in Shannadairn in the same election.
On opposite sides.
On opposite sides, but good friends. We had a co-op managers group, and there was another, for example, Tarek de Blockham, who's in Inishman and set up Inishman Knitwear. And he, again, he was a Dublin man. There was that group, and we all knew each other and we all supported each other. So we were familiar with the problems. And I think a lot of us identified that lack of services, basic services and infrastructure were the big problems hindering rural development, that the rural areas could compete. They could compete in an extraordinary way. And again, if you look at Inishman Knitwear, it has survived all the vicissitudes of the knitwear industry and has gone from strength to strength over all of the years, despite all the downturns and all the other challenges. And he's operating in an even more difficult milieu of doing successful business from the Aran Islands.
So initially the Shannon, then into the Dáil in 1992, I think. Bertie Ahern gave you your first breaks at ministerial level.
That's right, in 97. So I was only 5 years in the Dáil, but I was obviously another 3 years in the Senate before I became Minister of State. And I was made Minister of State for the Gaeltacht and the Islands. It was interesting because my senior minister at the time was my own cousin, Sheila de Valera, so there was a very good relationship there.
She was slightly younger, I think, than you, yeah?
She is actually slightly younger than I am. But we had a great relationship and we worked hard, but it was also a very enjoyable period.
What was it like, though, working closely with a close relative?
It was fantastic as it worked out, absolutely fantastic. And Sheila was most accommodating. And like the kind of mad thing that can happen in politics, I remember one issue that arose. The people of the Aran Islands came to me of Inishmore and they said, we want to build a football pitch. Now, it's a fairly fundamental facility to have a football pitch in the island. And they had an ideal site, flat site beside the airstrip. So I said, we'll give you a good grant for that, the usual grant the department gave. And the next thing, I got a phone call from the department saying that they were going to oppose the planning permission. And I said, what?
And why, presumably, as well?
And I said, why? And it's because it's an SAC and it's Macair. And I said, it's just beside the airstrip. How did that get built? Oh, that happened before the SACs came in. I have to recognise European law. There was a very helpful official in the department. So we sat down and we discussed the issue. And he said, look, I do recognise that it is the most suitable site on the island. And he said, I think we can get, you know, we can allow this if certain steps are taken. For example, there to be no imported soil. There was a certain prescription in relation to fertiliser, whatever, and the football pitch is there since. So in that kind of difficulty that arose, I had huge support from Sheila in resolving them. And they were affecting particularly areas in her constituency, the Burren, and also they were affecting Connemara big time.
As you say, it's not just you're on the De Valera side of the family. Eamon De Valera, of course, being your grandfather, who were involved politically. Your grandfather, Sean O'Keefe, he changed the family surname in the interest of maybe simplifying the Irish language.
Well, he wasn't trying to simplify the Irish language. He wanted to simplify the spelling. And if you look at books of 150 years ago, the spelling of Irish would be a lot more complicated than it is today. For example, Coney, C-O for the N-A-I father, would be C-O for the N-A-I-G-H-E. Very, very difficult for two groups of people in the pre-recording days. One, the people trying to learn the language from books. And the second thing was the native Irish speakers had been only taught to read English. So their association of the pronunciation was the English way you would pronunciate written words. So he devised this Letru Himple, and he wasn't the only one, there were three of them. And he changed his name as well. So some people think it was a makeup by Eamon O'Keefe, but it wasn't. It was Sean O'Keefe. And my father always used Brian O'Keefe. And
you knocked the O off it for electoral purposes then.
I didn't. What I said was, and I brought a court case to the Circuit Court, and the Circuit Court, that if you're listing all the names in the Gaeltacht and Connemara, so you've got Cuirini, Coeline, Coeves, and all the different families. And if you list them under the prefix O, Ni, and E, in the same townland, you find the different members of the same family all over the place. One group under O, one group under U, and one group under N. Now, that's a farcical way of doing an index. It's based on the way English indexes are done. So we made the case at the court that the county, the electoral register in Galway, should be done on the basis that the Páirc, Curreen, Páirc, O, because the surname goes first. So you don't write it Páirc or Curreen, you write Curreen, Páirc, O, Máire, Curreen, E. And the judge accepted the wisdom of what I said. Now, the interesting thing was that the judge didn't have any Irish, it was a reserved judgment. So the electoral register in Galway is now listed that way. So if you get in a register, you'll find the Irish language names, not the English language names, of course. So O'Connor stays O'Connor because it's missed, you know, female or male doesn't make any difference. So that was the basis of that.
But it stood to you electorally, didn't it?
Well, I wouldn't have a clue. They tell you that if you're towards the top of the ballot paper, if it happened to help me, well, so be it. I have to stress, this was not an individual decision, it was a court decision, and that is how the electoral register in Galway is maintained.
Very interesting piece of background there. But coming back to elections, after a stint coming up in 5 years as a junior minister, then you became a full cabinet minister in 2002. You got responsibility for community, rural and Gaeltacht affairs, the islands and drugs. Now, you were promoted to the cabinet, you're a full senior minister, but Sheila dropped out or was demoted by Bertie. Did that cause any difficulty or stress between you?
No, it didn't. And Sheila was very gracious about it. We're very close to this day.
In addition to your ministerial role and your political role, you were very active in visiting prisoners, I think, here and also in the UK. How did that come about? And are you still doing that kind of work?
The answer to the first question, how it came about, Albert Reynolds knew I was interested in issues in the north. He put me on the Forum for Peace and Reconciliation. And one day I was there and this lady explained how her children, who were Irish speakers, weren't being allowed converse with her husband, who was in prison in England, in Irish. I immediately saw, knowing my Irish history, and particularly knowing and having been brought up in stories about certain members of the family being in prison and various events that had occurred, when Granda was in prison over the years, and I knew very much from my mother, who was born when her father was in prison, that this was a very, very key issue, prisoner rights, and would become a key issue. So I offered immediately to go over and meet her husband. Now, as it happened, he had been transferred to the north by the time I got over there. But I did find the conditions very, very unsatisfactory. And what I found then was, I got more and more involved. Once you start in a thing like that, it's very hard to walk away. And between 1994 and 1997, when I became Minister of State, I did an awful lot of work with the prisoners, particularly in Britain, up and down, and visiting the Republicans. Now, my view is, and I think history will record I'm right, that if the prisoners hadn't been on board for the peace process, there was no peace process. If we hadn't advanced and highlighted the prisoner issue, which was key in the Good Friday Agreement, it just would not have happened. And I'm glad I had a small, but I think significant part in that.
Were you partly involved, was part of your work to do with persuading them that there was a political route to follow and that they needed to support it?
Look, I have boxes of letters at home where they were obviously indicating that they wanted peace. Remember, some of these were facing 20 and 30 years sentences. A lot of them had got involved because they believed that it was the only way forward in the political dispensation that was the North at the time. And I think they had come to this conclusion. They wanted somebody to listen. Maybe in other cases, I did persuade people to move forward. So I did that up to 1997, till my time, to the point time I was appointed Minister of State. I didn't really have much involvement in that work. First of all, most of the prisoners were let out. But back in 2011, I was contacted on behalf of a prisoner who was in McGambray, who had been convicted for something that happened in the 80s. So he asked me to visit him, and I did. When I went there, I found out that there was a dirty protest going on in McGambray, and then that was 2011, and I'm still at it to this day. Now, one good thing that has happened is the number of prisoners in Portlaoise has dropped dramatically. we're down to a very small number of prisoners.
There was one matter of controversy that arose, I think, after the event. You visited the former Sinn Féin councillor, Jonathan Dowdall, in prison before, I think that was before his involvement in the Regency Hotel attack came to light. Do you remember much about that visit?
Well, I do. What happened was, he had been in the wing, as they call it. In other words, he had been in Portlaoise with the Republicans. He had then disassociated and left, but they kept a kind of contact with him. And he was due for release. He had certain issues in terms of education and so on that he had raised. And I did meet him. Now, I also have the view that it would be a dangerous thing if nobody could ever visit a prisoner in Ireland, irrespective of what crime they committed. I think that that would be very, very regressive, because prison is punishment. But I think it would be wrong to start passing judgments on people who visit prisoners. Lots of people visit prisoners, and rightly so, and do great work with prisoners. And many prisoners change their view because of the contact with outside people.
What did you think, though, when it emerged about his role in the Regency attack?
I would say I was taken aback. And I rang the prison service and I said, you know, what's going on here? And I think they were as taken aback as I was. So it was just one of those things that came to light.
You didn't make it your business, say, to visit what might be described, you know, in an umbrella sense as gangland prisoners.
No, I didn't. I have visited prisoners who were in prison from my own constituency, but my focus was on the peace process. And you can only do so much.
Before we talk more about your own ministerial career, Eamon, I'd like to hear more about your own relationship with your grandfather, Eamon de Valera, founder of Fianna Fáil, Taoiseach for a very long time, then president for two terms. At what stage did you get to know him, and what kind of time would you have spent with him?
We knew him from the time we were kids, as long as I can remember. He used to often call at the house on his way into government buildings, and we loved that.
When he was Taoiseach?
When he was Taoiseach, yeah, before 1959, because I was born in 1950, and I can remember that well. My eldest sister was very special. She was the eldest grandchild, and she was the mathematician in the family. And, you know, the two of them used to spend a lot of time doing mathematics together, and she went on to become a professor of mathematics. So they had a very special relationship. But he was very good to all of us, and they were very ordinary grandparents. Now, one thing that was stressed to us growing up, that we had no status personally, just because our grandfather was president of Ireland. So once we left the grounds of Áras an Uachtaráin, or once we left when we were younger children, we used to go out to Black Rock. There used to be a kind of family tea in Black Rock on a Sunday. But once you left there, then you got on with your own life and you did all the things the children did. And that was very important, and I think has stood in good stead to us. And our parents were very strong about that. It was the way it was, and you took it for granted. So we didn't think there was anything strange in going up to Áras an Uachtaráin on a Sunday afternoon and spending the afternoon, you know, playing sports around the ground and so on. He was very down to earth, very ordinary, very kind.
Did he talk much to you, or did you ask him much about his earlier life, 1916, the revolution, taking power, being on the run, all of those momentous, tumultuous events that he would have been involved in?
We all asked him questions, and he was very good at answering any questions. I can remember one day he was asked about the issue of the oath, and he explained in great detail, which I can still remember, my sister asked him, about what had happened. And at the end, he said, you can now make up your own mind whether I took an oath or not.
Do you recall any conversations about, say, more contentious things, say, like the Civil War? Would you have asked him about that?
Well, he would have explained about, you know, the issue of the treaty and so on, and given his point of view. The issue often that's in the media is my grandmother's view of that. That's all clearly set down in the book that was published by Terry de Valera, because within that book, there's autobiographical notes that my grandmother had written as part of an autobiography I think she was going to write at one stage. And she quite clearly says that before Granda came back to Greystones, she already had made up her mind, and she was relieved that actually he was on the same side as she was. So she was very clearly on that. But that said, and this was one of her great abilities as a person, if you asked her about Michael Collins, she referred to him very fondly as Michael Collins, my boy. But she would always say that she disagreed with his view on the treaty.
Did she ever talk about the killing of Michael Collins?
I can't remember her, but he got shot in an ambush.
Mm.
I think it's only more modern times that people are making a long mystery out of it.
Mm.
And I think that the book that was written on the Hales brothers is very, very interesting, because there were two brothers, one on each side. One of them was involved in the ambush, and the other brother was the brother that got shot.
Sean Hales.
So I think Sean Hales, had a view and was looking for an investigation into what had happened when he got shot. So I accept that. I think all the evidence shows that it was an ambush.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember that being the big controversy in my youth. That it,
what's your view of the way your grandfather is portrayed, say, in media and particularly in film versions of his life that would have covered that in some detail? I mean, he was seen, I think, generally as somebody who was quite austere.
He lived a very plain and simple life. He wasn't austere on a personal level, definitely not. And I think anybody who worked for him or met him over the years would attest to that. One thing that really, really impressed me then, and then subsequently impressed me when I became minister myself, was something that I would have tried to emulate. And that was the fantastic relationship he had with staff, the really positive friendships that existed with staff members.
Did you ever talk to him or hear him speak about, say, the turmoil that engulfed Fianna Fáil after 1970 or from the late 60s with the troubles in the north breaking out? What was your sense of his view on that? I know he was above politics, couldn't speak publicly from the RS.
He was careful about those issues. He was careful about those issues and not speak out of turn. And he had a very strong view of how the presidency should operate. And that was natural because he'd been centrally involved in writing the constitution. If you look at the role that I think he foresaw for the presidency, it is central about the protection of the constitution, because that is protection of democracy within this country. And I think that over various crises, it has been clearly shown that the constitution is the bulwark that stops abuse of democracy, which is key in Irish society.
Some of the more recent presidents have stressed the importance of pushing out the boundaries of that office and maybe making statements that arguably are going beyond the terms of the office and the spirit of it, certainly. For instance, what do you think of the way Michael Dee has been performing in that position?
I think he's generally performed well and very well. And times have changed and media has changed. And the world has changed, but the clear way, if you look at the oath of office or the affirmation of office, which it more properly is, it is about being a protection for the constitution. And of course, if we go back to the time that the constitution was written, you had Mussolini, you had Franco, you had Hitler, you had Salazar, and so on all over Europe, and they came to power in various different ways. And it was important that the president was seen to be above day-to-day politics, so that if there was a constitutional crisis, they would have a big moral force in reining in any temptations that might be there. And we see in other countries at the moment that the idea of having somebody to rein in any overambitious people could be very important.
One of the interesting things about your grandfather's time, post-revolutionary, if you like, is that when he became an establishment figure, when he was Taoiseach and president, he renewed acquaintances with the man who arrested him, I think, during the 1916 Easter Rising, a British Army officer.
Yeah, he took the surrender in 1916, a guy called Captain Hitson. And in 1938, when the ports were given back and the Anglo-Irish agreement of that year was arrived at, he took the very generous thing of returning the binoculars that he had confiscated from De Valera through Neville Chamberlain to De Valera. And De Valera obviously thanked him for doing that and was very chuffed that that had happened. Subsequently, in 1948, he was invited by the 3rd Battalion, IRA, over to the annual dinner as their guest of honour and guest speaker. He came over again in 1966 and he was part of the celebrations of the 50th year of the Rising. There was an awful lot of correspondence. But what happened to me was I went to the Isle of Man. Now, there's a peculiar connection with the Isle of Man. I was asked to go there as minister for the Gaeltacht, but also because back in 1947, De Valera had done a tour of the offshore islands of Ireland because they had bought a new Corvette and they were trying it out in sea trials. He'd gone to the island of Barra in the Hebrides, and then he came down and he visited the Isle of Man. And when he was there, he found out that there were native Manx Gaelic speakers. So when he came to Dublin, he got the Folklore Commission, he bought them equipment, and they were sent over to record the language. And that's very, very important on the Isle of Man now. So I have received a number of invitations to the Isle of Man because of that connection and my role as a Gaelic minister. But on one of the visits, we were in the Manx Parliament and we had lunch. And when the lunch was over, I was invited in and said, "You'll have to meet this lady. She wants to see you." And when I went into a room, there were a whole lot of scrapbooks. And she introduced herself and she was Captain Hitson's grandniece. And she had inherited these scrapbooks that he had kept. Now, there was a whole lot of stuff in there. Sometimes, you know, just newspaper cuttings of what De Valera was doing. It's a treasure trove of stuff. I thought the best one was that they sent him a beautiful certificate in 1967. This is the 3rd Battalion, Old IRA in Dublin. They sent him a beautiful certificate making him an honorary member of the 3rd Battalion, Old IRA.
Captain Hinson joins the IRA.
And there's a lovely letter with it saying, "We think you might be surprised to get this, and we don't expect you to renege on your British citizenship or whatever, but we want to make you an honorary member of the 3rd Battalion, Old IRA." And I think that that showed a great maturity on both sides. And I certainly know Grandy appreciated it. Again, looking through it, there was an interesting one. His daughter subsequently worked in the Dublin in the British Embassy in Dublin. And on spec, she went up to the Oras. Obviously, she wasn't let in at the gate, but word reached Granda that she had gone to the gate and hadn't been let in. And the next thing, a message was sent to tell her to ring up the Oras, make an appointment. And I noted in the social and personal column that he cut out, she did get to visit Eamon de Valera in North Nuachtarán.
Extraordinary. Coming back to your ministerial career, there are a number of things you would have been remembered for. You are and always have been passionate about the Irish language, and you made it a legal requirement that was at state organisations in their annual reports, they had to do an Irish version as well as the English version of the, if I had that right. But the question would be asked, how many people will actually read those? And there's a huge cost then at, to prepare them and have them printed.
Well, there are two official languages in this country. There are two official languages in Belgium. The national language and first official language is the Irish language. So what we said was that a very small number of policy documents had to be published. And again, that went through the Oireachtas without demur. And then somebody somewhere started saying there was a huge cost. Now, there isn't a huge cost.
Translation?
No, translation is very, very, very cheap compared to composition. If you think about these documents, it's the composition that takes all the time. Translation, particularly with modern aids to translation, is relatively cheap. And it's getting cheaper as time goes on. And they do it in Europe all the time, and nobody seems to worry too much about the cost. And they do it into endless amount of languages. So the translation part doesn't actually stand up to rational argument. One other effect it had, but if you actually looked at the very, very small amount of documents that were involved, would actually say that if you have two official languages constitutionally, that was unreasonable.
You attached a lot of priority as well to the islands and investment in infrastructure.
The shortfalls in the islands were absolutely horrendous. And I set about dealing with that issue. Now, one of the things on an island is the most fundamental thing of all on an island is a pier, is a good pier. We did set about a big programme of pier building, the most expensive being in Inchmore, but which has been tremendously successful, but where a huge number, I think 300,000 passengers come in every year. A huge number of people visit Inchmore every year. And there is no safe berthage. So, yes, there was money spent. But I'm going to put it to you this way. When I became minister, and we keep talking, everyone says, preserve the islands, and they still dream about the Blasket Islands and give out that the people left the Blasket Islands and so on. But I was saying to myself all the time, we have this alive and well, the culture, the whole lot. And we've no basic services. So no non-Gaeltacht island, Clare Island, Inishbofin, Inishturk, none of these in the Cork Islands, none of them had a ferry service. And I put in ferry services. And islands are a huge attraction. They're a huge tourist attraction. So islands actually are economic generators. And I see this particularly in my constituency where lots of people go to Galway. It's either the Cliffs of Moher or visit the Aran Islands. So I think that if we look at islands upside down, that in fact the investment in the islands, which has been relatively small, the investment in the islands has sustained what are not only good places for the people who want to live there to live, but also economic generators. The second point I always made, there's no halfway house in these things. You either commit to taking all the people off the islands, and we're still criticised for what happened in the Blaskets. We're still criticised for the death of an island in Ishark. So if you're going to keep people on the islands, they want a modern lifestyle like the rest of us. They want electricity, they want modern telecommunications, they want jobs, they want all sorts of things. Now, the reality is, if you want to maintain a population, you either go the whole hog and do it. Now, what would be much more expensive and much more dangerous is if you didn't develop them or you only half developed them and you wound up with an ageing population and no young people on the islands. That's the most expensive arrangement of all. And a dying island is very, very expensive.
You were fortunate, I suppose, there was plenty of money available, relatively speaking, in the earlier part of your ministerial career, but then came the crash. Now, what are your reflections on that? I mean, we hear, you know, Lehman Brothers mentioned as being, you know, oh, well, you know, that was really the main cause of it. But when you reflect back on how the government behaved, that Bertie Ahern then leading on to Brian Cowan, what are the things you wish had been different or had been done differently?
Oh, well, I suppose I and everybody else wishes that we'd foreseen all of this. But certainly when we were sitting at Cabinet, that's not what the reports, the official reports that we were getting, OECD and so on, were telling us. We knew that there was going to be a slowdown.
The famous definitely. Soft landing was supposed to be happening.
And I remember the first cloud in the sky occurred in the middle of the summer. And I happened to be away at the time. And it was Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. Mm-hmm. The two American subprime. And I immediately got a bit worried. And I remember ringing one of the Taoiseach's advisors and saying, should we be worried about this? And I was assured that subprime wasn't going to affect Ireland. We know how quickly it did. So it was a big international crisis. There was an Irish dimension to it. One regret I have is that it seems that collectively we all lost our nerves. So we should have built roads and infrastructure and whatever in the period from 2010 to 220, because everything was cheap because there was lots of people looking for employment.
Yeah, except for the Troika was in town for a big chunk of that time.
Well, part of that, but raising money for infrastructure, there were ways, in my view, it could have been done. But what I would say to you is this. I certainly know for myself, and I could say it for my colleagues, this idea that we were all in with bankers, builders and so on. Now, the people in my constituency knew that, and they made that absolutely clear in 2011 when they returned me as the first TD elected in Galway West, because they knew my real life was on the ground with the people of Connemara, other than...
But were you not seeing signs yourself? I mean, like, in addition to, you know, what might have been happening internationally with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, just moving among the people, and there was probably nobody as close to their constituencies as yourself. Were you not picking up signs or concerns?
Well, they'd be concerned, and I'd have the same concerns now. And I kept remarking at the recent election, which seemed to me to be quite like 2007, where more and more was being promised by every side, including the opposition. Everyone was saying that we can buy our way out of every problem. I'd be concerned that just on the logic of human existence, what goes up tends to come down.
You mentioned about builders and so forth. I mean, were you a man for the Galway tent?
No, I think I went one day when the Ogra were there. I wasn't. I have no interest in racing.
But were you concerned at all when you saw the party cozying up to these people with money?
Well, I wasn't that aware of it. I used to hear the media reports of it no more than anybody else, but I wasn't hanging around in those circles. So it certainly wasn't something that seemed to be affecting policy as I saw it at the cabinet table. You know, a lot of good things were done in the north, and I think we shouldn't forget it. If you drive from here to Galway, drive from here to Cork, drive from here to Limerick, drive from here to Waterford, more railway lines were opened in that period than have opened in the last 5 years, despite all the talk about public transport. So a lot of good things were done. There was a boom. Lots of people were buying into property. All of the projections in housing. And this is an interesting point because people always point to the oversupply of housing. All the projection of housing said that if we arrived at the European level of number of people per house, we would need the number of houses we were building. We got into a short-term oversupply in 2008, 2009, 2010, 2011. By 2013, in my office, we were seeing a critical undersupply. So again, the great tragedy is that we didn't find a wherewithal during the downturn to complete all of those so-called ghost estates that are very scarce in the ground now, because we could do with all of that housing. And that became apparent very early in the following decade.
At what point did you sense or fear that we might have to look for outside assistance? That happened, I think. Well, first of all, I mean, there was the guarantee given. Was that 2008, 2009 to people's savings?
Yeah, but it was to people's savings. And I think we must stress that. People say you guarantee the banks. We didn't. We actually guaranteed all the deposits. The second issue that arose, should you guarantee the Tier 2 bonds? Mm. But the guarantee in 2008, the night of the famous guarantee.
Yes.
The following day, the issue of what should be guaranteed in total was raised. And the argument was that if you didn't go the full hog, that you create a wobble in the market and you get exactly the thing you were trying to avoid as a run on the banks. Now, people have forgotten Northern Bank. People have forgotten people queuing up at the banks here to get their money out. So the last thing you needed, if you've got pressure on the banks, is a run on the banks. So it was decided that the only way of creating full confidence in the banks was to guarantee all the money deposited in the banks, irrespective of where it was. Whether it was right or wrong, you do these things in good faith in real time. But I'm just explaining what the consideration was.
Could the country afford that guarantee?
But that issue actually is a very fair issue. So the initial guarantee was 10,000. In liquid terms, could the country afford 10,000? The amount of money, there was a very large amount of money involved even at 10,000. Then it went to 100,000 and that didn't stem the tide. The question was at that stage, could you, if everybody came in, so the whole idea was to avoid a run on the banks, which we did. Now, the second issue that then arises, supposing we had allowed the banking system collapse, either in 2008 or 2010, would we be in the strong economic position we have, or would we have created total international mistrust of our banking
system?
One of
the phrases.
And the other issue that I was very strong on, and I still stick on this, is that the state couldn't default. That the one thing, the banks, but the other issue is that the state couldn't default in its borrowings because, again, it would have long-term ramifications. And remember how quickly we rebuilt the economy here.
It wasn't just deposits, but bondholders. The phrase was, you know, why can't we burn the bondholders?
Yeah, and I've explained that's what the Tier 2 investments were, the bondholders. Because if you created that uncertainty, the fear was that you would get to run the banks, and the whole idea was to avoid the run on the banks. I mean, can any bank, let's put it a different way around, can any bank today, even with the much improved liquidity ratios they have, no bank can withstand everybody pulling their money.
It was a very difficult time. And again, looking back on that, I mean, OK, you got elected. I think you were one of the 20 Fianna Fáil TDs returned. Brian Lenihan, the late Brian Lenihan, the only one returned in Dublin. What do you think of the way your party was led through those years? I mean, you had, first of all, Bertie Ahern as the first Taoiseach in whose cabinet you served, and then Brian Cowan.
Well, I think, as I said, given the information we had at the time, you have a very different perspective, and being in and knowing what you were presented with, you have a very different perspective than somebody on the outside. And you're doing everything in real time. I think, you know, in hindsight, that there were mistakes made, and we certainly, there was a lot of people investing in houses on a speculative basis, and I think that came to catch us. But I'm not sure that too many other people saw that. That wasn't the official warnings we were getting. Do you take the advice of economists and OECD and central banks and so on and so on? The red lights were not flashing and we didn't ignore them. That's the point I would make. Were all the decisions right? No, obviously not.
What did you think of the tribunals? And I'm thinking particularly of the Mahon Tribunal, where it emerged that Bertie Ahern had been getting financial support and he had various explanations about domestic matters that, you know, created needs for him and so forth. But did you find that very disappointing?
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that, first of all, cabinet ministers are like any group of people. We all work together, but we wouldn't have known that much about people's private lives or who they associated with or whatever. From what I knew of Bertie and what I know to this day of Bertie, that was all very surprising for this very simple reason. He lived in a very modest house. It seemed to me that the only recreation he took, other than two short breaks a year, was to go to Croke Park, which wasn't costing him a fortune. And he seemed to be working all the rest of the time, and he was very hardworking. So he wasn't somebody who was living a lavish lifestyle. And I think it took a lot of us by surprise when the issues arose that eventually led to him resigning as Taoiseach back in 2008.
And what about his successor then, Brian Cowan, who Bertie Ahern had, if you like, acknowledged as the person he would like to see succeed him in the same way as your grandfather proposed that Sean Lamass, or at least facilitated that. How do you think Brian Cowan fared as Taoiseach?
I remember him telling us, look, we had hard decisions to make and that it would be very bad for the Fianna Fáil party, but it was the right thing to do for the country. And I have this very clear vision of Brian knowing the political consequences for himself and for the country, but feeling he had to take the corrective action that was taken and that did turn the country around. I don't think he was the best at selling the message. I think he might have been somebody who didn't appreciate fully the importance of the PR aspect of getting your message across. But do I think he acted in integrity in terms of the hard decisions we took? Yes. I had to make hard decisions. I was in social welfare. Brian Lenihan was in finance. They were the two departments that were taking the hard decisions. I think it's interesting both of us got elected in 2011.
They were, as we say, difficult times. The situation, I mean, there was a doubt, I think, at one stage, or people were asking, has Fianna Fáil got a future? That came, I think, particularly after the Moriarty Tribunal reported. Clearly, the party did have and does have a future. Biggest party now in the Dáil, biggest party in government, Micheál Martin back as Taoiseach. You didn't always have a smooth relationship with Micheál Martin, did you?
No, there were certain issues I disagreed with them, yeah. But there were policy disagreements, some personal disagreements.
There would have been a fairly serious difference. I don't mean in a personal sense of animosity, but you took a completely different view on, for instance, the merits or otherwise of sharing government with Sinn Féin.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
His argument is that, you know, they, leaving aside their slowness, as he would see it, or maybe refusal to acknowledge things in their past from the paramilitary side of things and to make proper apologies, he would argue and has argued very strongly that economically their policies would be very bad for the country and effectively incompatible with those of Fianna Fáil.
What I think you find is, if, just supposing for argument's sake, they were in government tomorrow, you find that there are things you proposed in opposition that can't operate. I remember when we were in the throes of the downturn, the opposition at the time, Fine Gael and Labour, saying that there were all sorts of ways out of the problem that were totally painless. And you might remember yourself all the ads that were giving out about cutbacks and hard decisions. And then they just came in and implemented the 4-year plan that Fianna Fáil had agreed, some of which was needed to, was reform that needed to happen, and some of which was in the plan was never implemented and should happen. But I think that when it wind up in the government and they would have been in a coalition government no matter what way it happened, I think you'd find that the more impractical propositions would be quietly dropped. But you find that all the time in government.
Would you prefer or have preferred to see Fianna Fáil coalesce with Sinn Féin rather that than coalescing with Fine Gael?
For the very simple reason, yes, because I'd rather to be pulled by people being over-ambitious than under-ambitious, by a bit of radicalism rather than conservatism.
Do you regard Fine Gael as under-ambition?
Well,
under-ambitious?
I think Fine Gael, by its nature, is a very cautious Conservative Party, yes. And I think that was obvious during the last decade.
How do you think things would be different, say, if Fianna Fáil had gone in with Sinn Féin? What would the programme of government now look like, and in what way would it be different?
Well, I think we would have dealt with faster with the housing problem, with issues like that. The biggest social issues facing people are very practical issues like housing, medical services. I think there would have been more aggression to move forward and to deal with these issues.
Would there be a greater push towards having a border poll, for instance?
Well, I have very strong views that the idea that's enshrined in our constitution, that it's for the people of this island to decide how they're ruled and to make the rules for the people of this island, that that's fundamentally democratic and fundamentally would be good for the people of the country. The idea that a parliament of well-meaning people in Westminster who are, with the best will in the world, know very, very little about Ireland, make the rules for Northern Ireland, ultimately, I think has its flaws. How we get from where we are to where I'd like to be on that issue is something I think we need to look at very hard and very intensely over the next 4 or 5 years, and certainly something that I'll be hoping to engage with. I've dealt with British ministers, remember. I had 3 of the North South bodies under my remit. I was there during direct rule. They're so well-meaning, but they just literally don't understand. I always remember, and small things often stick in your mind. There was a minister for sport for the North during direct rule, and she openly admitted to me that she had never realised, I don't think she'd ever heard of the GAA, not to mind, how important it is in the North and how important it is, particularly in the nationalist community in the North, and how central it is. And she was utterly shocked, and she was the Minister of Sport. I've nothing against British people. I've worked very closely with them. I have great affection for British people, but any more than I could make decisions for London, I don't think they can make decisions for Ireland.
Would it be fair to say that at the start of the previous coalition, maybe Leo Varadkar was, if you like, more vocal in supporting or expressing support in the desirability of a united Ireland than Micheál Martin, who, if you like, put great emphasis on his Shared Island initiative?
Well, the Shared Island initiative is a fine initiative in its own right, but there are more fundamental issues I think we're going to have to look at. And ultimately, the sovereignty issue impacts on this island. And with the work I'm doing with prisoners, you'd see a big difference between the North and the South in the approach to how we de-escalate and persuade people onto the peaceful path. They'd take a much more security view, because security is controlled from Westminster. MI5 would have a big input into that. And therefore, they take it totally different. And I see this every day of the week. So we're all the time coming back to people who don't understand the psyche, trying to resolve problems they don't fully understand.
When do you expect to see, or do you expect to see, that referendum taking place? It's in the gift, well, not in the gift, but it's a decision to be made by the British Secretary of State at the timing in Northern Ireland.
Well, he or she has to call it whenever it's apparent that there's a majority. The Good Friday Agreement is black and white. And the other thing that's black and white in the Good Friday Agreement is 50% plus one. Now, whether that's good or bad is irrelevant. That's the Good Friday Agreement. I don't think that's the issue. I think the issue is, have we thought through what it's going to look like if, for example, Britain decided to start transferring power from Britain to the Northern Ireland institutions? For example, Britain could decide to give us the extra powers that the Scottish Parliament have to the Northern Ireland Assembly. So there's a whole lot of steps on the way that you could have to bringing us to change. The second issue is, do, for example, the people of the North maintain the medical system they have and the health system they have?
Should the programme for government be emphasising that more, at least?
Well, I think people need to go working on those issues and need to go thinking on those issues and need to go debating those issues. And I'd hope to be part of that debate.
There's going to be an election this year. The president's term will be up in November. Have you any interest in contesting that election?
I haven't thought about it, and I never sought the office. I did believe that Fianna Fáil should have run in the last two elections, so I would have stood if I'd been asked, just on the basis that I do believe that Fianna Fáil in 2011 and in 2018 should have contested, but the party took another decision.
Presumably that means you think Fianna Fáil should have a candidate this time in 2025.
Oh, absolutely.
Are you available?
Well, I haven't been asked.
But if you were, or were?
I think about it. And not something I'm mad anxious to get, but I think about it depending on the circumstances.
What about Bertie for the Oras? He's not denying it, and I've heard suggestions that his main reason for not denying it is just to annoy Micheál Martin.
I don't know. I leave Bertie's thoughts to himself. He said, you know, the question you have to ask yourself, would the parliamentary party select him?
And what do you think?
I'm not in the parliamentary party, but I think that's an issue that one would have to look at. So I hear speculation in the media, but it's not a question of him deciding. It's a question of the parliamentary party deciding. And the only precedent we have for that is a very keenly contested convention with Albert and Mary McAleese. And I think John Wilson might have even run that time. And it didn't go the way people had predicted. So it's very hard to call these things. But there was a very wise decision, in my view, made at that particular time.
Eamon O'Caoimh, thank you so much for your time and your insights. To hear more in this series, go to rte.ie/podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. There you'll find a whole range of episodes with our wonderful guests who share their insights, including former Laskeon Corla Deputy Catherine Connolly, manager of the Saw Doctors and founder of the Galway Arts Festival, Ollie Jennings, former managing partner of PwC and son of the late Minister Mary O'Rourke, IDA chairperson Fergal O'Rourke, Director General of RTE, Kevin Backhurst, plus many, many more. And remember, if you hit the follow button on your preferred platform, you'll be alerted when a new episode becomes available.